history over the past six decades has almost convinced me that Napoleon was right when he said that history is the agreed upon lie. It depends on the historian I'm reading. And I think, though I'm no historiographer, that I've come up with at least three approaches to Southern history, two of which are anti-historical. The first of these is the Puritan approach. In the simplest language, these historians purify the past to punish the present and control the future. That's been going on for a long time. However, in recent years, this intellectual abuse has become more widespread and intense. Like a hanged horse thief, the flesh, blood, and bone of Southern history now lies buried in an unmarked grave. For politically correct scholars, all that is left is mere abstraction. It was the same with John Brown's body. Julia Ward Howe couldn't bear a song that dwelt on the human decay of her hero. So in her battle hymn, she transformed Brown into God himself and the Confederate Army into the legions of the devil. In Mrs. Howe's lyrics, we have some clue as to why history in general, and Southern history in particular, have undergone a profound change over the past few decades. It is the New England mind at work, industriously fiddling with the complexities of time and place to bring them into conformity with a preconceived paradigm. I believe the ultimate source of this narrowing vision of the world was Pierre Delarame, known as Petrus Ramus, a French philosopher who was killed at the St. Bartholomew's massacre in 1572. Alas, they didn't get him soon enough, for he already had written a book on logic. He was part of the Protestant movement to reinvent philosophy and theology along non-Aristotelian lines. Inevitably, the reinventors latched onto Proclus, Plotinus, and other Neoplatonists, and for a short time made a god-awful mess of Western thought. Ramus transformed Aristotelian logic into a system of simple classification. If you want to know what reality looks like, really looks like, you can find Ramus's diagram of it in Perry Miller's The New England Mind. It is a network of dichotomies that looks like a 10-generation genealogical chart toppled over on its side. This chart was understood as a paradigm or overlay to be superimposed on existence. As with the bed of Procrustes, any unwanted complexities were chopped away like so much scrap meat. Ramus's logic was translated into English by the poet John Milton, and I believe I'm right that a copy of it was brought over on the Mayflower, along with the Cabots and Lowells. The first theses at Harvard University were written on Ramistic logic, and its influence on New England thought was incalculable. It has sifted down through three centuries of American life, its corrosive strength undiluted. Thus, the war between the states is increasingly rendered as a morality play, a pious and freedom-loving people versus cruel and conscienceless slave beaters. In this self-serving dichotomy, slaveholding Union states like Delaware, Maryland, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Missouri are left on the Ramistic chopping block, along with hundreds of other human complexities that defy simplistic categorization. We all know about these complexities, but if we try to introduce them into the debate, we become apologists for evil, the grapes that Mrs. Howe's God tramples under his Boston bred feet. The second of these historical approaches is the mafia approach. Eliminate rivals, encase the feet of all opposing facts and ideas in concrete, and drop them into the East River. Thus, Southern history and all its symbols disappear one by one from the scene, like soldiers from a family whose territory has been invaded by the Gambinos. Confederate monuments are relocated in unkept cemeteries, accessible only in dry weather by dirt roads. The battle flag has disappeared from a Capitol dome and a state flag. A boy in Kansas is suspended from school for merely drawing a picture of it. A college course that presents the South in a favorable light is abruptly canceled in the middle of the semester. A book called Facts the Historians Left Out is banned from bookstores and national parks because, quote, it doesn't give both sides. A boy who checks out a biography of Robert E. Lee from his high school library is beaten into unconsciousness. Activists demand that the bodies of General Forrest and his wife be exhumed from a Memphis public park and reburied God knows where. Streets and public schools, which once bore the names of Southern heroes like Washington and Lee and Jackson, are being renamed for more recent and politically correct figures. I fully expect that one day soon, the points of the compass will become East, West, North, and Martin Luther King. The mafia approach derives its success from sheer muscle. Fat little pig-eyed mayors all over the region sweat and twitch when the NAACP or the SCLC or the Reverend Jesse Jackson swaggers into town, lighting cigars with $5 bills, offering protection at a price. Likewise, college presidents suppress free speech on campuses because they are afraid of politically correct reprisals. The approach is not as old as the Puritan approach. It dates back to the 1960s, when the New Left captured academia and decreed that academic freedom was no longer a useful idea. Thus, Herbert Marcuse, a professor at the University of California in San Diego, wrote that certain things, quote, that certain things cannot be said, certain ideas cannot be expressed, certain philosophies cannot be propounded, certain behavior cannot be permitted without making tolerance an instrument for the continuation of servitude. While the polite left continued to support the concept of academic freedom, Marcuse boldly called for, quote, the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote aggressive policies, armaments, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, or which oppose the expansion of public services, Social Security, Medicare, etc., close quote. As one New Left anti-war activist put it in the 1960s, do you know why the demonstrations and protest movements succeeded? Because we didn't play by the rules of the game. Our movement wasn't organized democratically. We kicked the Dow people off the campus because they had every right to be there. It was our unrepressed intolerance through anti-permissiveness that brought our actions success. But who gave us the courage to be intolerant and unpermissive? I think Herbert Marcuse more than anyone. He is the New Left's professor. In both of these anti-historical approaches, the facts, the personalities, the larger movements of history exist only to be manipulated or overpowered. Whether through intellectual prowess or sheer intimidation, those who practice these approaches to history have as their ultimate end the control of the minds and souls of us all. The third of these approaches is difficult to characterize. At the very least, it involves the submission of self to what's out there, what God made, or if you prefer, what made itself. In literary studies, the best critics begin with the assumption that words have meaning and relate in some mysterious but true way to the real world. The best historians, I would guess, begin with the assumption that there is a real world and that they must be subject to it. In these dishonest times, that's a mighty hard thing to do. I would think this approach, which is truly historical, embodies, at the very least, the following characteristics, which are no more than the evidence of radical honesty. One, it keeps theory and abstraction in their proper place, like performing lions in a circus, recognizing that they can jump at you and tear you to pieces. You can stick your head in the lion's mouth, but you'd better not keep it there very long. Most Southern historians, including some of the older ones, have been walking around headless for years. Two, this approach neither hides nor distorts the other side of an historical argument. It's one thing to say that an adversary is wrong. It's quite another to pretend he doesn't exist, or to summarize his position in such a simplistic way that even his old gray-haired mother, who loves him more than life itself, would reject it with scorn. Three, it is uncompromisingly committed to the pursuit of truth, even to the point of permitting an historian to change his mind. If Eugene Genovese, who will be speaking in a moment, comes as close as anyone I know to following these rules. As an avowed Marxist, he should have lost his head at an early age. He probably did, but he's found it and reattached it where it belongs. Someone from the Philadelphia Society sent me a one-page bio for Gene, which began by saying he had once been an organizer for the Communist Party. I knew that, but I didn't like to be reminded of it. It's not that I think any less of Gene, I don't. It's just that I'm forced to think more highly of communists than I think. Two, he has always given the other side a voice in his own work and in any platform over which he has had control. He even invited Mel Bradford to speak at NYU, telling him in a letter, "You'll speak for about 30 to 40 minutes, then I'll turn my goons loose on you." He also, when Mel was having such a hard time in that fight over the National Endowment for the Humanities, he also sent him a mafia cookbook with passages marked as to how to take care of his enemies. Unfortunately, it arrived too late. Beneath this levity lay the strictest adherence to the principles of free debate that you're ever likely to see. I figure the test is this for us. If you were on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho and saw Kenneth Stamp beaten and bloody lying in a ditch, would you help him or pass on by? I wouldn't even turn my head. I'm sure Gene would get him to an inn and pay his bills. Three, as for changing his mind, he's done that too. Most scholars think they know everything by the age of 35. I was precocious and knew everything by the age of 19. I suspect Mel Bradford knew everything from his conception. I console myself by remembering that changing your mind is only a virtue when you're wrong. Apparently, Gene isn't quite as adept at rationalization as I am. Finally, let me say a word about intellectual courage. It's one thing for people like me and Mel Bradford to buck an entire intellectual establishment. No matter how often we bowed and scraped to the Yankee gods, we would never have been considered for a Pulitzer Prize or a full professorship at Harvard University. Gene Genovese might have had both had he not chosen to follow these hopelessly outmoded rules, which apparently were firmly rooted in his remarkable conscience. It's barely possible that Gene is not an intellectual saint. He was, after all, a college professor for a good many years. But he's the nearest thing we have to one in this sorry band of thieves and murderers that academia has become. Let's hear what he has to say.